Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thank you for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you from the wonderfully cozy studio in the back of Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And you are listening to Good Food, the show where we talk with people who are using food as a vehicle for social good. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I am thrilled to be joined today by Roger Dwarin, who is the founder and director of Kitchen Gardeners International, a nonprofit organization and large community of people from all over the world who are growing their own food and who are helping others to start doing the same. So, Roger, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I'm delighted to be here, Daniel.
So the explanation that I just gave of your organization and what it does is probably pretty simplistic. Will you just tell us a little bit more about Kitchen Gardeners International and how it started and what you guys are up to?
Well, I started it actually almost 10 years ago. We're going to be celebrating our 10th birthday in November.
Wow, happy pre-anniversary.
Well, thanks very much. It's been quite a ride. And I started it up initially. It was more of a project, just a twinkle in my eye for the first several years. I just said to myself that we needed to have more food gardens or kitchen gardens, as I call them, and that the best way to get those kitchen gardens would be to rally the people who are already growing them and to sort of tap into that as a resource base. But for the longest time, for nearly 5 years, like I said, it was more of a pet project than anything else. But I thought that we needed these gardens and that there could also be a lot of fun that could come out of just bringing gardeners together, whether it was in a neighborhood or online. So that was really the impetus for KGI. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've really sort of been trying to figure out, you know, what it is we're going to use with all these people to sort of accomplish. And, you know, each year we sort of get a new answer to that question. You know, what are 30,000 gardeners good for? it's fun to see sort of the answer reveal itself over time.
So what did that initial rallying cry to gardeners look like? You know, you wanted to bring together a big community of people who were growing their food. How did you find them? Where did you find them? And what was sort of the call to bring everybody together?
Well, the very simple motto was Kitchen Gardeners Unite. You know, that there was some mm-hmm. benefit to be had individually, but also in terms of the bigger picture by just bringing some gardeners together to share information. And sort of the backstory of KGI was I was pretty active and passionate about the slow food movement in the 90s. I was mm-hmm. living in Europe at the time and was really seeing it just take off there. And what I said to myself was that as much as I loved the slow food movement, I felt like there was a need for a group of people who really had their hands in the dirt, that uh-huh. there was sort of I don't want to say necessarily a more profound love of food among people who are actually growing it, but it is a different sort of love as opposed to maybe the urban dweller who is visiting a farmer's market or a farm-to-table restaurant. When somebody actually grows his or her own food, you really get to know it. You know the work that went into it. You know that basil just doesn't magically appear in gardens uh-huh. in July and August. it was planted, you know, very carefully and lovingly, in most cases by seed, sometime, you know, back in the spring. And so I thought that there was this this opportunity to bring gardeners together and a need also to bring them together, because the other part of the backstory, when I was living in Europe in the 1990s, I was working for an environmental NGO mm-hmm. called Friends of the Earth. So I really knew my stuff about the environmental challenge that we're facing. And I said to myself that, part of the bigger picture of environmental sustainability is coming up with sustainable food systems. And I felt like there was just a bit of a hole in the nonprofit landscape for an organization, a gardening organization, that also got sort of the food part of it.
So, the idea that you have to rally gardeners and to try to get more people growing their own food sort of takes as its assumption that not many of us are doing that, and either because we don't do it or because we don't know how. But obviously, that wasn't always the case. How have we come to this point where we need somebody like you, sort of shaking us and telling us to go grow something as opposed to sort of being naturally inclined to want to do it ourselves or to have to? How did we get to the point where we don't really have our hands in the dirt that much anymore?
Well, it's an excellent question, and don't take this as a slight at all, Daniel, but you're sounding a little bit like my Belgian mother-in-law. The voice is a bit different, but the content is more or less the same, because she, up until this day, is occasionally asking me or my wife, so what is it exactly that Roger does, and why does he need to do this? Because in certain countries and cultures, they've managed to hold on to the gardening tradition a lot better. I asked that question
as a red-blooded American who knows that we've lost that culture already. So I'm wondering how that happened.
Lost it altogether.
Yeah.
But there really were a couple of dark decades in there. But just to give you some stats, at the peak of the Victory Garden movement, so we're talking early 1940s,
mm-hmm.
the data was that nearly 40% of our fresh produce, this is, good red-blooded American produce, was coming from gardens of some sort or another, either a backyard garden or a community garden or a school garden or something like that. Now, we don't, unfortunately, have very good data anymore on that, but if it's even a couple of percent now, I think we'd be doing well. So we did manage to lose it along the way, and I'm sure that some of your other guests over the weeks have given you a lot of information about how that came to pass. But it really had a lot to do with our culture changing, our farming methods changing, people having other things that they wanted to do with their time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really, that requires, unfortunately, a very long answer, but the short answer is that we're a country and a culture that's in motion, and as I said before, fortunately, we really haven't lost all of our gardening roots, so to speak.
Yeah.
But you do have to maybe dig a little bit deeper to find them.
Wow, the gardening metaphors just are plentiful.
They come all by themselves, Daniel.
It's amazing. So, we've lost a little bit of that culture, but say there's a group of people who are, intent on getting it, on reclaiming it and sort of embracing it again. What do you find are the biggest challenges that face people who want to get up and start a garden and start growing their own food? And how do you sort of walk people through those obstacles?
The challenges differ from, one person or family to the next, one place to the next. I think that, one of the big ones is simply a lack of access to ground, to land.
Right.
We have become, one of the other big trends over the past, 50 years in particular, has been increasing urbanization. So more and more people are moving into urban and suburban settings, and a lot of those folks simply don't have any ground to plant. So that's one of the things that we need to address. How can we make our food system fairer in terms of actually giving people access to land? Then another big piece of the puzzle is sort of access to information, the
mm-hmm.
know-how that people need, because you actually do need to know a couple of things at least to successfully plant a seed and
yeah.
cultivate it. And that's also wrapped into this whole historical question, which is that, you know, we're probably, in the United States at least, one, two, and in some cases three generations removed from producing a significant quantity of food at the, let's call it the homestead level, the family level. So, you know, before, that information was really within our households. It was in the form of a mother or a father who knew how to do it, or perhaps a multi-generational family where you had a grandparent living in the house as well, who, you know, knew that information really backwards and frontwards. And since we don't have the same family structures in place, we need to have other sort of social structures in place in order to help this garden know-how flow, and that's one of the things that KGI is trying to provide.
So in practice, how would we go about using KGI as you know, that resource for information that may no longer exist in our families? But you know, if we go to your website, how do we interface with you guys if we have a question about how to plant something?
Well, we're set up as sort of a social network. In that we have a lot of tools on our website. You just need to register, and from there on in, it's pretty clear in terms of the user interface. If you want to ask a question, answer a question, share a recipe, share a photo, that type of thing. A lot of the same things that you might see on Facebook or some other social platform, but it's all focused on gardening and canning and cooking, so it really has, I think, a very different purpose than a more general social network. So that's, I think, one way that people can get involved with KGI. But we also recognize that gardeners are very tactile people, and in many cases don't enjoy spending hours and hours on the internet because they'd rather be out in their backyard gardening.
Right.
So we try to have other things in mind for them. And in fact, we've got our big party coming up in a few weeks called World Kitchen Garden Day,
okay,
which has very little to do with the internet and everything to do with people just getting out into their own backyard and inviting a couple of neighbors in to see what a kitchen garden looks like.
So what is World Kitchen Garden Day? Is that a regulated holiday? Is that one made up by you, and how do we celebrate it?
It is completely made up by us.
Nice.
And it's always fun to see it get picked up as if it were something real. But I guess the more people who recognize it, the more real it becomes.
Yeah, sure.
But I remember a few years back when somebody sent me a link, once again through the internet, to some sort of story about World Kitchen Garden Day that was posted on the BBC's website. And I said, wow, little do they know that this whole thing was just made up by a guy in Maine. But the more people who recognize it, you know, the more substantial it becomes. So what people do on Kitchen Garden Day is really up to them. But what we tend to see is people organizing informal walking tours of gardens. That's, in fact, what I do in my neighborhood. Others will just do sort of a homegrown potluck with some family and friends. In another parts of the world, places like India, places like Africa, we see more formal type of activities. In the case of India, I'm always amazed, floored by the amount of energy that they have and interest that they have in Kitchen Garden Day. It's not unusual for a Kitchen Garden Day celebration in India to consist of a parade.
Wow.
With all the local dignitaries arriving. So it sort of depends on, you know, on who you ask.
That's unbelievable. All right, well, we need to take a quick break, during which I'm going to think of how I'm going to celebrate Kitchen Garden Day this year, but we will be right back. Stay tuned.
Awesome.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
You're listening to the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
I've been walking this same old road. It's the same old road. I've been walking too long. I can't walk it no more. It's the same old song. It's the same old song. I've been singing too long.
We are back. You're listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network, and we've been talking with Roger Dwaran of Kitchen Gardeners International. So where we left off, Roger, you were telling us about World Kitchen Garden Day and how it's celebrated in different parts of the world. So I wanted to pick up on that and ask you, you're by definition, you're an international organization. So I'm wondering what you've noticed about how, this country's relationship with growing our food might compare to the cultures in other places, as you sort of alluded to before with your mother-in-law. Some other countries might be a little further ahead of us agriculturally, at least in home gardening terms. But I'm wondering what sort of differences you've noticed and what we might be able to learn from the people in other countries that you work with.
Well, you're right. Your sort of summary is right there, Daniel, in that I know Europe better than any other part of the world aside from the United States. And I think the Europeans really have held on to their food traditions a little bit more tightly than we have over the years. It's really part and parcel of their culture. I think you could say the same for the United States. One of the big differences, I think, is that Americans, when they become interested in something, they become passionate about something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with the good food movement as it's sort of playing out right now in the United States, I'm actually quite hopeful about what's going on. Just because the people who are involved are incredibly passionate. When we decide that we're going to start to make our own beer, for example, don't get in our way. And I think we're seeing some of that same energy now in the food garden movement, where there are some newcomers to the movement who are saying, this isn't that hard. The food tastes a lot better than the stuff that I was getting before, definitely from the grocery store, arguably better than the food that I'm getting at the farmer's market, because, it was a salad, for example, that I just harvested 10 minutes ago,
uh-huh,
as opposed to one that was harvested maybe a day ago. So I think that, Americans, once they get interested in something, they really go all out. So I think that we're really at the beginning of what I think is going to have to be a very long and perhaps never-ending food garden revolution in order,
yeah,
to meet the different challenges that we have. But once again, I feel pretty hopeful about our chances.
So in what ways do you see that, do you see this movement sort of growing, from the ground up, so to speak? But, in the same way that the local and artisanal food movement has really taken off and even been sort of adopted and co-opted by, larger food companies, is there that same room for growth when it comes to people growing their own food? For instance, if you're growing a bunch of food in your garden, can you start, canning and pickling and selling at farmers markets or other venues? How are there regulations that govern that? How might this be able to grow?
Well, I think there are different ways it can grow. It can definitely grow the way that you're suggesting, in the sense that a home grower could decide to scale his or her production up in order to do some value-added things, and in order to be able to sell at a nearby farmer's market. We actually in Maine have a I think, a vibrant food sovereignty movement where there are a lot of people who are agitating at the very local level in order to remove some regulations that prevent people from just selling essentially out of their own front yard or driveway. In my hometown of Scarborough, Maine, we actually have those regulations already in place. We have the right, and we've actually exercised this right, my sons and I, just to open up sort of an informal farm stand from our driveway.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. We have the photos to prove it, too. But another way that I think that the movement can grow and needs to grow is via other types of food gardens, other type of kitchen gardens aside from simply the backyard home garden.
Mm-hmm.
And if I sound hopeful, it's because I actually have some data there. We are focusing at the moment, KGI is focusing on a relatively new program called Sow It Forward, which is a grants and partnership program where we partner with like-minded groups and gardens working at the local level in the United States and abroad. And we did this program for the first time really this year, and we announced that we were going to have these grants available, and we're expecting to have a couple hundred applications for these grants.
Wow.
Well, we had 928 applications.
No.
And the vast majority of those applications were really strong and actually deserved a grant. So I think that that sort of speaks to how the movement is growing. And I, you know, I've been working in this area for a while now, so I felt like I had a pretty good grip on the different types of projects that were out there. But what I discovered is that it's really moving quite quickly and really creatively, in the sense that, you know, in addition to having applications from schools, we knew we were going to be getting applications from schools.
Mm-hmm.
We also got applications from community gardens. We also got applications from homeless shelters, from libraries that have installed kitchen gardens, which are either demonstration gardens or gardens that have some sort of a connection with a local food pantry. We had applications from prison gardens. We had applications from all kinds of different nonprofit groups that you wouldn't necessarily associate with kitchen gardening.
Wow.
But who have started up kitchen garden projects. And I think that that is the sign that this movement is growing and that it's healthy.
So obviously you're only able to give grants to a certain a limited number of people, but obviously the demand is pretty high. So how, you know, you talked earlier about you know, people wanting to grow food in urban spaces and a big problem being access to land. I'm wondering if there are larger forces, be they, you know, private institutions or federal or local, state or city policies that can sort of foster the kind of work that you're doing on a larger scale, being it, you know, making more room for urban agriculture, giving people access to land. Do you see those sorts of things in place moving forward?
Little by little. I think one of the things that we're the proudest of is we recognized a few years back that there was an interesting sort of political lever that could be pulled in order to take the kitchen garden movement up to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
And we focused for nearly a year and a half on this. We discovered back in the year 2008 that there was one address in particular in the United States that was lacking a kitchen garden, and that was 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So we ran this campaign called Eat the View, which, like I said, ran over the course of about a year and a half. We had over 100,000 petition signatures. We did some viral videos. We got mentioned in every major newspaper in the United States, the New York Times about 5 times over the course of the year.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was unbelievable, and it had very little to do really with me. It had everything to do with there being this movement of people out there that wanted this thing to happen. And I was more the person that just was trying to figure out how to channel all this good energy and direct it towards the decision makers in D.C. And I think, you know, the work that First Lady Michelle Obama has done and continues to do to promote not only kitchen gardening but healthy eating in general is really, really important. Some people scoff at it a little bit and say, oh, it's just symbolic. But we're really seeing some of that symbolism start to play itself out in some more real ways in the form of, you know, programs like Let's Move. And I think also, perhaps more importantly, just greater awareness among policymakers, among decision makers, among power brokers mm-hmm. in the United States, that these gardens really do make a difference. And I think that that is probably the essential message that KGI is trying to deliver, because a lot of people do look at a little garden and say, you know, what difference is that going to make? Well, on the face of it, a single garden obviously is not going to make a huge difference. But when you're talking about getting, you know, millions and millions of people growing these gardens, it really does add up.
Now that you talk about that, I can't help but remember this wonderful TED Talk that you gave, which if you guys have not seen it, you should go check it out, which you called a subversive plot, I think it was called, where you talked about sort of growing your own food as a kind of subversive activity. Can you just touch on what you meant by that, or what you mean by it, and how, you know, thousands and millions of people starting to do it could really start to make a huge change?
Sure. I mean, the impetus for the subversive plot was I wanted to try to figure out a way to get Dr. Evil into one of my presentations from the Austin Powers series.
Right.
And I meant to do that within the first 30 seconds or so of my talk. But the sort of the more serious answer was, you know, with the subversive nature of gardening, you know, I said to myself, food is not only a form of energy. It's not only the thing that our bodies run on, but it's also a form of power. And to the extent that we can get more people growing their own food, we're helping to put power in their hands, power over their diet, power over their health, power over their pocketbooks. And the subversive part of all that is that I think that power is a zero-sum game, which means that if we're giving power to one set of actors in society, we're taking power away in similar measure from some others.
Right.
And if you think about who has power in our society currently over food, over finance, over health, it's not a bad thing at all to have some of the power taken out of their hands and put into the hands of the people.
It's an amazing point. Okay, so we're almost out of time. We have been talking a lot in the abstract about your organization and kitchen gardens and gardening in general. I didn't want to let you go before asking you, what does your own kitchen garden look like? What's growing there? What are you and your son selling out of your impromptu farm stand?
Well, we've got about 30 to 35 crops. Our yard is about a third of an acre. We're in the suburbs of Portland, Maine.
Okay.
With a small garden in our front yard, which we call our White House garden, because that's the one that we initially planted as a prompt or challenge to the future president at that time.
Great.
And then we have our big production garden in the back. So that's really where most of the food comes from. But we've got really just about everything that can grow in Maine is growing in our backyard, from potatoes and zucchini to things that you wouldn't necessarily associate with Maine, like artichokes.
Wow.
Because I think it's important for me as somebody who's been doing this for a while to keep it interesting and to always have a challenge. So, you know, artichokes and cantaloupes, things like that, that are a little bit trickier to grow, they're on my challenge list this year. But we've got all the regular, you know, cast of characters in terms of beans and peas and salad greens, leeks, onions, garlic, pretty much everything that you can think of.
Are you going to be cooking dinner out of the garden tonight?
We are, as a matter of fact. I've got my brother coming by a little bit later, and we're just going to be doing a simple pasta dish with lots of garlic and lots of parsley. The two, I learned this recently, the two sort of balance each other out. The chlorophyll in raw parsley sort of counteracts not only the smell of garlic, but to a certain degree the taste. So if you're somebody who only mildly likes garlic, if you add some chopped parsley or any sort of chopped herb or green to your dish, it'll actually make it taste better and you won't have sort of the lingering effects that sometimes come with garlic.
Okay, well, I can't possibly think of a better note to end on than pasta with garlic and parsley. I may go home and make a batch of that myself. We're out of time. I want to thank you, Roger, so much for chatting with us today. It was really great to have you on the show. I hope you'll come back again sometime in the future and tell us how the organization is going and how many gardens are cropping up. You guys have been listening to Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I will talk to you again in a few weeks on the next episode of Good Food.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.